Welcome to 7 Things EMS, a continuing education offering from Limmer Education. 7 Things EMS is designed to give you what you need to succeed in EMS. It's conversational, informational, and without the fluff.
And welcome to this episode of 7 Things EMS podcast. And I can tell in advance, this one's going to be a good one. Anytime you have somebody with deep experience, personal experience, and a passion for something, it works out to be a good episode. And that's who I have here. I'm happy to be with Rob Ravindahl, who's a program director at Southeast Community College in Lincoln, Nebraska. But even more, in this podcast, which is about service animals, how we deal with them, how we understand them, how we make things work and flow well for everyone, Rob also has a service animal. Rob has experience in EMS over, well, you're looking at 30 years, Rob. And unfortunately from that, I have experienced some PTSD, which is why you have your service animal. I'd like to welcome you to this podcast, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about service animals.
Thank you, Dan.
Well, let's get into it. That's our hallmark here as we get right into it. Number one, what is a service animal? Tell us.
Well, according to the ADA, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that's the law, the federal law that governs service animal law and access in the United States, a service animal is an animal, specifically a dog or a miniature horse, that's specifically trained to perform task or work for a person with a disability. And that task or work needs to be disability related. So, for example, my service dog performs deep pressure therapy and blocking. If I hand him to another person with a disability who perhaps they have, let's say they have mobility issues, my service dog isn't necessarily a service dog for them because he's not trained to perform the task that that person needs.
Well, can you, in this, we have a lot of things to do, and I like to keep an order, but we're EMS. We can skip around. Tell us what the dog does for you. What will the dog identify and do for you?
So for me, when my PTSD, I get triggered or it flares up, a lot of times I have no cognition that that is happening. I don't even realize it. And so Carnes will alert to me. He's an Irish setter and he's about 75 pounds and he's a very tall Irish setter, but that's because he's tall enough to get onto his back legs and stand up and he can actually get in my face if I need that. And he'll start licking me, which is kind of like my clue. Like he's trying to distract me and say, Hey, focus on me, because he's trying to stop the trigger. The other thing that he'll do is he'll perform deep pressure therapy. So like as I'm sitting in this chair, if he determines that I need it or if I command him, he'll get up in the chair with me and get in my lap and he'll put pressure on my abdomen in an effort to stimulate the vagus nerve and make it so that physiologically it becomes difficult for my body then to fall in line with the fight or flight symptoms.
Okay, that is, to me, nothing short of amazing. And we talked as we were, discussing the podcast before we got started. He may, as a result, pop into the picture sometime, which I know that this is an audio podcast, but we do some video promotions for it. So maybe he'll get a cameo in this. I don't know how that'll work, but I certainly hope so, being a dog lover. So I think that's fascinating. I think that we're doing well, and we can work into point number two. And that's a simple statement, but it's a big statement. Service animals help people. You talked about how your dog helps you, and maybe you have an anecdote, where you had a feeling, or maybe you're in a place. I'd love to hear more specifics about that. But since you're knowledgeable about service dogs, I mean, you can read newspaper articles about everything from dogs predicting seizures to identifying diabetics to so many things that animals can do. Let's talk about that in a broad scope. I'd love to hear your things, but then any other insights on what animals can do.
Sure. Well, I think the big thing to note is that just like almost just like technology, as we go through time, and in essence, it's kind of like software developers, you know, that we don't know the next big thing yet because we've got to have something in the middle to launch the next big thing. And really with the dog, the service and service dog specifically, their scope keeps getting expanded and expanded and expanded as trainers and healthcare providers begin to realize, hey, the dogs can do this. Where it used to be, you know, Dan, when you and I were kids, we might see a sign in the post office that said, only seeing eyed dogs allowed, right?
Right.
And it was, for a long time, it was like, well, that's what they can do. They can guide the blind. And then through time, I'm going to say largely because of the Iraq-Afghan war, and all the veterans coming back, it kind of really came into prominence as PTSD service animals, psychiatric service animals. Now they're used to help kids that, or even adults with severe autism. These dogs are amazing. The kids that have have a tendency to be a runner, these dogs actually go and block the kids, so the kids can't run, and the dogs are fast enough to catch them, where the parents might not be in the case of small children.
Right.
You know, as you mentioned, diabetics. I mean, diabetics use service animals to alert them to high and low blood sugar situations, especially the brittle diabetics. These dogs can sense impending seizures and alert their handlers so that the person will lay down or be in a safe place when the seizure hits. Mobility issues for people that have issues with mobility. You'll see them sometimes helping people in wheelchairs, where they might provide power to the wheelchair and pull the wheelchair, but also, you know, imagine shopping in the grocery store and needing something off of the bottom, you know, off of the bottom shelf when you're in a wheelchair, and the dogs can actually retrieve items for them and get them. And I mean, it's amazing what they can do.
Wow. Is there a story that you feel comfortable sharing about you and tell me your dog's name again?
So my dog's name is Carnes, spelled okay. C-A-I-R-N-S.
Okay. Is there anything you can share that you feel comfortable sharing? You tell me about you and Carnes, and actually I'd be curious about your day, how the dog fits in from morning to night, and maybe somehow a time when you really, like, the dog really pulled me out of something.
Sure. Well, the first thing that I can say is that my recovery from PTSD has been, I mean, for me, it's been very profound. The difference between me with the service dog and without is the difference between me being at home and being shut in versus being able to work and be a productive member of society and be an active, more importantly, you know, be active with my children and my family and get through the day.
And be a paramedic program director.
Yes, and be a paramedic program director, you know, expand my education. And I mean, truthfully, it's the difference between working and living at kind of at my best or not working and living maybe at my worst. As far as Carnes, where he helps me the most is crowded public situations, like airports, the grocery stores, some of the big box stores, which we won't name, that I only go in if I absolutely have to, even with my service dog, because there's just so much movement. There's so much stimulation. But Carnes makes all the difference in the world. He prevents people from startling me by coming up from behind me, because he does block. If somebody's coming up behind me, he'll move behind me and create a physical space so I can't be crowded. But he'll also lean on me to let me know how close someone is, so I don't get startled. And it's a game changer. It really is.
Amazing. I mean, that is just so amazing. And what type of training? I know this isn't on our list, but you have me so engaged in this. What type of training does the dog go through?
Well, the nice thing is the ADA doesn't have a specific regimen that it requires. And just for the people listening, so they know, the service animals can be trained by their handler. There's nothing to say that they cannot. So for Carnes, he was actually rescued from an Irish setter rescue, found him in East Texas, found him stray when he was about a year old. They had a lot of these rescues have dog trainers that volunteer some and come in. This trainer picked up on, hey, this dog's just, there's something different about this dog. And I was working with a trainer that I hired privately. And anyway, they became in contact and they screened the dog and said, yes, this is going to be the dog, the service dog for Rob. And then the trainer took the dog and worked with the dog 30, 40 hours a week for about, you know, I want to say about 4 or 5 months. And there's no set time frame. It just depends on the dog, just like us, Dan. If the dog really wants to work and really likes the task they're doing and whatever, it can go quicker. You know, and some dogs take longer. Some dogs just never get there because, you know, we're not all meant to be artists or paramedics or whatever. And it's kind of the same way with the dogs.
Well, I guess I can safely make an observation that both for Carnes and for you, we're very fortunate to have met each other, where he came from and what you need. I think that's just outstanding.
But yeah, he's amazing.
Good. Not every animal is a service animal. So you had mentioned that dogs and small horses, and that's under the ADA as that works. Can you tell me more about what can be and can't be a service animal?
Okay. Well, the ADA, the first thing to note is some states and municipalities might expand the ADA as far as what they'll permit and consider a service animal. But for the purpose of our conversation here, I'm just sticking with the federal aspect because that applies to all of us, regardless of where we live. But the ADA is very specific. It has to be a dog or a miniature horse. And before I scare any of the EMS providers out there that think, oh my gosh, you know, we're going to have horses in the ambulance or something like that. Something to note about these miniature horses is they're usually, think of it like this way, they're going to be about the size of a Great Dane. So they're generally between 100 to 120, 30 pounds usually. And most of the time when you see them, they're going to be for people with mobility issues, especially people, like if you think about, imagine a retired firefighter that's maybe 6'4" and has this huge frame, you know, maybe they're 275, 300 pounds. That would be really difficult for a dog, even a Great Dane, to support, where a horse, just by their nature and their build, they're perfectly suited for that. The other one is as far as the dogs are concerned, breeds, the ADA does not segregate or delineate what breeds a service dog has to be. So they could be anything from a Chihuahua, they can be a Great Dane, they can be a Rottweiler, they can be an Irish Setter, a German Shepherd, a Lab, what have you. But the biggest thing there is the breed of the dog or the size of the dog is going to be suited towards the person's disability and what they need. So, for example, a brittle diabetic, for sometimes you'll see them with like almost like a harness that they wear on their chest, and it will hold a small dog like a little Chihuahua, and it will hold it near their on their front of their chest, and the dog is basically able to constantly smell the person's breath and pick up on it and alert them.
For some people, that could be hazardous duty pay, having to smell their breath all the time.
Right.
I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I had to get that.
No. But, you know, that might work for a specific person with diabetes, but obviously because the dog needs to be able to mitigate the disability or have disability-related work, Chihuahua, for what I need, just doesn't have the stature to do it.
Okay. Now, I think right here in the middle, our point number 4 of our 7 things, really might be the big one. We have a lot of important things to talk about, but where can a service animal go? I think that a lot of our conversations we had building up for this talk about your experiences. You've already said it helps me in stores, and you told me some other anecdotes while we were preparing for this. You've had issues, and I think a lot of people with service animals face issues in access. So let's talk about that, starting by, you know, where can a service animal go?
Sure. Well, the simple answer is, and according to the ADA, a service animal is permitted to go anywhere the general public can go. The Department of Justice has a nice two-page document that's written in very much plain English that you can just find by going to ada.gov, and then in their search bar, put service animals, and you'll find this info sheet. They specifically reference in this info sheet that there are, in essence, two places that are just universally considered that service animals cannot go, period, no more discussion. And that would be an operating room and a burn unit. And the reason for those two is obviously the sterility of the environment. Okay. Now, the other key thing to note here is that this means they can go in an emergency room. They can go in an ambulance. They could go in a taxi cab, a public shuttle or bus. Any public building or any business that's open to the public, if the general public can go to a specific room or area of that building or that business, then so too can the service animal go.
Okay. But I don't think it works out to be that easy for you, does it?
Well, it would be nice if it did. What we really have is we have a disconnect. You know, service animals are not part of the typical initial education for EMS, what they do, where they can go, what their rights are. That's just not part of the equation. And as such, I didn't learn about where a service animal could go until I had one, which when I look back on my career was really kind of scary, because if I would have run a call with a patient with a service animal, I would have absolutely done the wrong thing. And I probably would have been like, what are you talking? Like, we don't take dogs in the ambulance. We don't take dogs to the hospital. But it happens more in healthcare than what a person would really realize. And usually the barring of access, it usually stems on almost every case that I've experienced. It stems from just a lack of education of the staff and of the providers. Stop me, Dan, but this might be a good place to add, like, what can we ask service animal owners?
No, let's go for it. This is a flow. Let it go.
But the big thing to note, though, is when we talk about what is and is not a service animal, obviously the ADA says it has to be a dog or miniature horse. It has to do work or perform tasks. So like for Carnes, he does deep pressure therapy. He does blocking. He does alerting. Those are physical tasks. If I said Carnes is my buddy, he comforts me, and he provides emotional support, then he's not a service animal under the ADA. He does not have the rights to access to anywhere the general public can go, as my service animal does. So really, this leaves providers then with saying, okay, well, how do I know if it's a service animal or not? Because there's a lot of misconceptions out there that, oh, they have to wear a vest, or the vest has to say this, or what have you. And the ADA does not require service animals to wear a vest. And sometimes that's for many reasons, but one is the vest might interfere with the dog being able to perform its work for a particular person with a disability. And also, it could be that if you think about it like this, imagine that we're in Arizona and it's 110 degrees outside and, you know, it's the summer. Obviously, I don't really want to have a vest on my dog because I want to try to keep him as cool as I can. But we're allowed to ask to determine if an animal is or is not a service animal. The ADA permits any business entity to ask two questions and only two questions. We can ask, is that a service animal required to mitigate a disability? And we're permitted to ask, what work or task has the animal been trained to perform for you? Hmm. As a rule of thumb, anyone that balks at that, says you can't ask me that, whatever the case might be, if they do anything other than answer those questions, now we can say this is not a service animal, and no, they don't have the access rights of a service animal.
Wow. All right. That's, now I will always say people have to follow their own, you know, their protocols and, you know, the usual legal disclaimers. You know, I think a lot of times people in the know would probably not even pick the battle and take the dog. I mean, I have to tell you, I've been in restaurants and airports, you know, places where you think, you know, on planes, where I think people would have a natural, I don't say natural, because it'd be averse to say, well, you know, a dog in a restaurant, or you've got a, you know, German Shepherd on an airplane. I've seen them. Now, for me, if the dog went to lay down by me, I'd be happy being a dog lover. But people may have some aversions to the restaurants, to the air travel, to the other things where a dog legally has the right to be. Have you experienced that, and how does that work?
You're talking about aversions from just the general public or bystanders, so to speak? You know, sometimes they do, but the way I approach it is I just don't engage with them, because my dog's there for me, and that's what we have to do to be there. And, you know, I've had instances, I had a particular instance in a store where this man wanted to ask me if he could pet my dog. And I said, no, I'm sorry. No, you can't. He's working, you know, and the man threw a big fit and just whatever. It was ridiculous, but it, you know, and that one was mitigated because A, I walked away, and B, one of the employees of the store recognized this and said, I'm sorry, sir, but you know, you're not permitted to intimidate or harass our customers. You're going to have to leave. And so, you know, by and large, you know, it's one of those things, you can't make everybody happy all the time. But the general public, I mean, most people, I mean, like you said, I mean, you love dogs. A lot of people love dogs. And by and large, people recognize that, hey, they're there. They might not understand it, but they're kind of like, ah, whatever you got to do, you know?
You know, I think we're kind of leading into number five. And I think there's still a lot to talk about. We can certainly have a have our flow here. But I put this in because there's a lot of time. I've been in EMS a long time. I teach a lot. And you talk about this in class. You talk about it. And this, the number five is, not all service animal stories are true. People love a good story, whether it's true or not, right? That people look for reasons not to let a pet in, or they look for a service dog in, or a service animal. They look for problems, or they come up with these stories of people who may try and scam the system. You know, there's an assumption, well, they're trying to get their dog on the plane or be able to take their dog places. But really, that's not the case a majority of the time. These animals are valuable and they're there. What are your thoughts on some of these fringe stories and other things that happen? And do they take away from your experience as someone who really benefits from a service animal?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a good question, Dan. Well, I think ultimately when we talk about these stories, sometimes we have to acknowledge bias and opinion and whatnot. And we can't really, I can't control what somebody's biases are. However, what I can say is that as EMS providers, we're public servants, whether we work in, you know, for a nonprofit or a for-profit entity, what have you. We operate under the guise of a tremendous amount of public trust. And the public trust that we're going to do the right thing for the right reason and the right circumstance. And when we talk about the service animals, and as we'll get into access and whatnot, it's really important to say, okay, even if someone has a horror story, where hypothetically they ask the person the questions, the dog bit somebody, so on and so forth. Mm. It's really important to understand that we have to look at every individual case on the facts and the merits of that case. The nice thing here is that the ADA sometimes an opposition to allowing a service animal is liability. But the really nice thing is the ADA is very clear when it says that an entity that permits a service animal access is held harmless from any liability that that animal imposes. So if my service dog were, for example, in the back of the ambulance and my service dog bit a provider, then I'm personally liable for the service animal's action. If the service animal, you know, just like if I were in a restaurant and the service animal, you know, used the bathroom on the floor, which that's obviously a reason the ADA says you can remove the service, you don't have to allow access if the animal is not housebroken, and you also do not have to allow access if the animal is not under the control of the handler. So anyway, in either case, the dog biting, the dog using the bathroom, whatever, all of the responsibility of the financial responsibility lies with the handler of the service animal in those cases. Some of these other stories about, well, this is my service biter or whatever, people are getting confused. They're getting confused in the terminology and the vocabulary. Where that spider or, you know, I remember something about a peacock, somebody's trying to get a peacock on an airplane. Those were emotional support animals, and they're just, that's kind of like comparing apples to oranges.
All right. That makes a lot of sense. I think that clears that up. I wasn't really aware of that difference, that dichotomy. And I will, in the show notes for this episode, include a link to that ADA document, that 2-page document you talk about, so people will have that there. Well, let's shift in to the last couple of things that we have to talk about. And I think this, now that we've really laid a really great foundation about what is and isn't, what can and can't, all these things, let's talk about an actual EMS call. Right. Let's talk about what we do, because you made this pretty clear when we set this out, that there's two things to do, that we take care of the patient, and we also have to consider the animal on the call. And well, and quite frankly, the third, I guess, would be the relationship between the two.
Right. Well, the first thing to note is that obviously EMS calls are as dynamic of a situation as they come. Where the ADA specifies that the animal must be under the control of the handler. A couple things for us to note here is the person with the disability may or may not be the handler. And what that could look like is, imagine, let's just say, for example, if there's a couple, right? And it's obvious that they're together. And let's just say that one person in the couple has a seizure disorder. The dog alerts them. They lay down in the store aisle. They have a seizure, and EMS is called. When EMS arrives, say for example, the patient is in status epilepticus, and obviously the disabled person is not in control of the animal, but the other person of the couple, say they have control of the animal, and they are giving the animal commands, and the animal's working, and it's not preventing us from providing care, then we need to acknowledge that, well, the animal's still under the control of its handler. It's just that the handler is not the person with the disability. We see that a lot too with children who maybe just are too small, or because of cognitive issues, they just can't handle their own service animal yet. The other aspect of this is we say, okay, if we take the animal with the patient, which would be the preferred method in nearly every case, if we take the animal with the patient, then we want to give it access to the patient so that the animal, the dog, can still perform its work or task and what have you. And one particular call like this that I heard of was from some providers were sharing with me that, hey, we went on this person that has a seizure disorder. They have this service animal, and we really enjoyed having the dog with us. We took him along with us in the ambulance because every time a new seizure was going to start, the dog let us know. And so we could just make sure that we were ready. So they can help EMS providers in that way, too.
It's too bad the dogs can't push benzos. They could fix everything. Right?
Exactly. But the big element there is when we're talking about the call, we want to try to keep the patient and their service animal in contact with each other as much as possible, but it needs to be a rarity where it does not happen, where they're not in contact. But a situation that might look like maybe they're not in contact is, let's just say, for example, that I'm with my service animal, we're walking in the park, and I go into immediate cardiac arrest, right? Well, if that happens, obviously the providers need, I'm the primary reason that they're there. They're not there for the dog. So they need to do their jobs and they need to provide care. If it's not possible in that case for me to, for Carnes to go with me in the ambulance, in his case, he always wears a vest when we're in public. If it's kind of obvious, hey, this is a service animal, then providers should follow whatever their local protocols or what have you will allow, so that the animal isn't just turned loose, you know, so that they're, you know, they're in the custody of whether it be animal control or a family member is contacted, whatever the case might be. But they need to kind of recognize the service animal is property and is a medical device. It's very expensive, and they need to basically look after it in the same way that they would if they had the same patient with a mechanical wheelchair in a public space.
Interesting. You gave a lot of different scenarios there, which I really like. And that's, I think, important for people to listen to make those considerations. Many times, EMS is a very time-sensitive thing, what we do. Strokes, like you say, that person and status, you know, these things. We want to get moving, a trauma, perhaps. And considering what to do with the animal is a concept that may have to be done on the fly. It might be worth thinking about that in advance, having some policies. You know, if an agency doesn't have a policy and they don't understand what to do under stress, I mean, stress does not always lead to great decisions. So I think having those policies in advance would be helpful.
Absolutely. That's a good that's a good tabletop conversation for administrators as well as field providers to say, okay, what in our system, what do we have? How could this work? In some systems, that might mean that they have a chaplain available, or that maybe they have law enforcement roles on nearly every call, or whatever the case is, whatever their resources are. But they need to do the best that they can to not so much make sure the animal gets a bowl of water right now, but just to make sure that custody of the animal is maintained so that afterwards the patient and the animal can be reunited just like you would be with any other medical device. If I were in the airport, had cardiac arrest, and I'm carrying my CPAP machine, you know, obviously they wouldn't, the providers may not have time in that case to gather up all of my belongings, but someone would be there that would gather up my belongings and tag them appropriately so that afterwards, if I survive this, I could gain my property back.
You mentioned the concept of a medical device and also the cost. Not to put you on the spot, but do you have any sense of what it takes, what it costs to put a service animal in service for someone? Any indication or ideas on that?
Yeah, so that's a bit of a moving target based upon how much work, you know, what work the animal does, how much liability there is for the trainers and that. If we're talking about guide dogs, we're pretty easily talking about $100,000.
Wow.
So for a seeing eye dog, $100,000. Typically, I mean, a lot of the money for the service animals is, I mean, training is a big thing. Imagine, I mean, if whether the person trains the dog themselves or has the trainer do it, it's a tremendous amount of time and work. So generally speaking, I would say on the lower end, 15 to 20,000 is a good starting point.
Wow. So there's certainly the value, obviously, is beyond words and money to the people that need the service animal. But this is something certainly not to be taken lightly as far as the value of that animal, not only to the person, but for the amount that's been invested in the training and getting the dog or a small horse to where they are.
Yes.
All right. We have one more thing. Well, before we move on, any anecdotes, any advice, any insights you would give about here's the patient, it might not be a code or a status or, you know, anything like that, but when the animal, you know, is in the truck with a person, when you say near the person, can you give us just a little bit more on what it's going to be like in the back of the truck with the patient and that service dog?
Sure. Well, that's going to change a little bit based as ambulance designs. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if in a year or two, we don't see a design that is service animal friendly. Maybe they have some sort of restraining system for dogs there or something. But, you know, a pretty good case, a patient like me, for example, if I were, you know, having a medical emergency that was, you know, I'm conscious, I'm oriented, I can control my dog. I could pretty easily command Carnes to just lay on my lap on the cot, and he would sprawl out. And he's 70 pounds, and he's a big dog, but nonetheless, he would curl up probably right between my knees. And where he is wearing a vest, if a provider was concerned about, you know, the restraint aspect, I mean, you could take the seatbelt that went across kind of by my knees and make it so it ran through his vest. And really, Carnes wouldn't. In fact, I had a situation a few years ago where I had a near anaphylactic reaction, and I went to the local emergency room in a small town, and Carnes just laid on my kind of on my legs there in the bed, and really didn't cause any problem to anybody, and was just he just wanted to be where I was. I mean, he was kind of helping me in the process. That pressure on my legs was kind of helping, so I wasn't having to deal with PTSD and the allergic reaction at the same time.
Yeah, right. No, that's awesome. And the person who's conscious that has the service animal will probably help facilitate that. And it'll be something that they are probably more than acutely aware of.
Absolutely. And I would say make them a part of the, you know, ask them what they need. And they'll be happy to tell you.
Yeah. And I think this leads really well into our last point, and the timing here is working out perfectly. Be an advocate. And I guess the concept here is how to be an advocate for a patient with a service animal. I see, you know, in the ambulance, making things work, making sure everyone's comfortable, meaning providers, patient, animal, but also you're going to be walking, you're going to be taking the patient out of the ambulance. There's going to be a service animal involved, and you're going to be now bringing them into the emergency department, or maybe now in urgent care, or just someplace where now it's not just the patient, right?
Right.
It's not just their bag or anything else. Now we've got a live animal, which has needs, and the patient has needs. How do we advocate in that situation, or how do we advocate other times for that patient and the animal?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is access. Access is huge. And access in advocating for the patient, knowing what the ADA says, knowing what questions you can ask. Also, people with service animals love it when you ask the two questions the ADA says you can ask.
Gives you comfort. They have a clue, I'll bet.
Exactly. It tells me that they know what they're talking about. And it is a breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
And also notice this. I've been in four rather large hospitals And I have never once been asked the questions the ADA allows, which just shows how little we just don't understand. But as far as advocating, I'm going to say it starts from the time we make contact with the patient. Think of the animal as a medical device. And what I mean by that is when we make contact with the patient, we see that they have a service animal, right? Or maybe we ask the questions, now we know. Don't interact with the animal. Don't treat it any differently than if the patient had a cane or a CPAP or a wheelchair. We wouldn't talk to their wheelchair. Just treat the patient like we would anybody else. Ignore the fact that the animal's there, unless we need to ask them, hey, how can we accommodate you best? But the other thing I would say is what I'm seeing nationally, kind of all over, and it's this, if I put these dots on a map, it's really from one coast to the other and everywhere in between. There's getting to be a lot of EMS policies that say, as soon as you find out that the patient has a service animal, you're to call the hospital on the radio and let them know. And I would argue that good advocacy for the patient would be to ask the patient, would you like me to inform the hospital that you have a service animal? Because really, there's nothing that they need to do. There's no reason that they need to know. It just has no impact on the care that we're gonna give the patient. And it would be a lot like informing the hospital of our patient's race, or, you know, if it just doesn't have anything to do with the reason that we're here today, it's just irrelevant information. And usually when negative outcomes happen or access issues happen, it's when people have time to ruminate on it. And that's where, like you said before, not all these stories are true. That's where some of these things start coming out, and now access is an issue. So if we find a situation where our patient with a service animal is being denied access to the hospital, to the emergency room, the first thing we can do is we can know what the ADA actually has to say, and we can say to the providers there or whomever is denying access, hey, this is an ADA requirement. This has to be accommodated. And then if it's still access is still not there, then ask for a supervisor. Escalate this up the chain through the hospital, because they're going to have a compliance officer. They're going to have someone in charge that should know what's going on with service animals. At the same time, utilize our chain of command and let them know, hey, I'm having an issue. And then as an absolute last resort, don't be afraid if your patient's like, hey, I don't want to be here. These people are denying me access. They're trying to separate me from my service dog. Like, I don't know how to say this any differently. It's a horrible feeling being told that, like, it's okay for you to come here and spend money, but we just don't accept you. And don't be afraid to, if the situation is such, maybe if you need to take them to another hospital and you're locality allows for that, don't be afraid to do that. And then lastly, be an excellent documenter. If you have an access issue with the hospital, with a patient with a service animal, your documentation is going to be the best advocacy you can provide for that patient. If you can document, you know, who denied access, what were the circumstances, so on and so forth, that's going to be the best advocacy. Because in the end, if that bad scenario happens with this patient, ultimately our goal is we don't want this to happen again. And without good documentation, then the facts can't be evaluated as facts, so that the facilities can look at the facts and come up with training plans that would maybe mitigate this from being a barrier in the future. And at the same time, your administration won't have the facts readily available to be able to work with that healthcare facility about, okay, guys, this isn't cool. How can we do this better? And in some cases, it might be the Department of Justice gets involved and has an investigator look at the facts. And not every time that they get involved is it always punitive. A lot of times it can be, but really their ultimate motivating factor is they're like, okay, how did this happen? And how do we prevent this from happening again? And how do we educate other healthcare facilities, EMS agencies throughout the country? Hey, this is what happened. This is how it could be prevented. Because ultimately they don't want to keep evaluating the same case over and over and over again, just happening in different localities or in different facilities.
I have to tell you, that was a wonderful, finish and continued insights into that. And the part that I'm sitting here thinking about is that radio report, because I probably would have asked you, should we do a radio report? And ultimately you're saying, don't make a non-issue an issue. That it really, right. It if you brought their CPAP in, if you brought their meds in, if you had any other medical thing, you wouldn't say that. And I think that that's really interesting, but asking the patient. All right, I'm going to ask you one more question again. Will you please, for everyone that's listening, repeat the two questions that you can ask? I just think that's so important when you're evaluating a service animal. Do that. Ask me. Just tell me those questions again.
So the questions permitted that we can ask is, we can say, is that a service animal required to mitigate a disability? And we can ask, what work or task has the animal been trained to perform for you?
That's awesome. Now, at the end of every podcast, and we're perfect, right on the mark here, I give everybody a chance to say a last word. Primacy and recency, people remember what they hear first and last. What's the message a passionate person like you, who has a service animal, who really seems to want to advocate for this? What's the last word? What would you tell somebody listening to this that if they took one thing away, what is it that you'd want them to know?
I'm often reminded of the phrase from Chief Brunicini. I think I pronounced it correctly, from Phoenix.
Oh, yeah.
Big customer service guy. And he just said, just be nice.
Alan Brunicini was an amazing man. What a storyteller. What a influence. I had the unbelievable good fortune to sit next to him at a dinner once. It was like sitting next to royalty, right? and there is something about being nice that is a foundation for so much of what we do. And I think when we talk about the advocacy, how to take care of people, how service animals help people and everything else, I think it's just an amazingly simple yet very powerful last word to put through. And I like that very much. All right, Rob Ravindahl, paramedic program director in Lincoln, Nebraska, and someone who's benefited from a service animal. I just want to take a second now here at the end to thank you for sharing these insights and experience with us. And hopefully people will listen to this podcast and be able to not only handle calls better, but to be nice and to have good things happen to the patients they take care of with service animals.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for listening to a 7 Things EMS podcast by Limmer Education. If you've listened to this podcast on a streaming service and you're interested in getting continuing education credit, please go to lc-ready.com for more information.